It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one if you like it. Today, I have a conversation with Chad Pergram, who covers Capitol Hill for Fox News. All of the different inner workings of Congress, the history of Congress, are something that is near and dear for Chad. And so it was great to talk to him about the end sequence for those on Capitol Hill prior to heading out for their August recess, the different things that are going on there, the January 6th committee, and obviously everything that's going to be coming post-November in terms of the change of leadership in Washington. Chad Pergram coming up next.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Chad Pergram, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I want to talk to you about a couple of different things, but let's start off with kind of this rush that happens toward the end of every Congress headed toward the August recess. There's an attempt to cram a bunch of things through at the last minute in order to get out in time to go back home and campaign, head into election season. What are we looking at right now on Capitol Hill?
Well, Congress really works best on deadlines, and this is probably the second biggest deadline that we get each year because this is usually the second biggest recess, at least in terms of importance, the August recess. It has a little more import in an election year because people really want to get home and campaign on both sides of the aisle, so they want to take most of August off. That's something that's kind of often protected. Now, in terms of the legislative track here, it's not as muddled as we've seen in other Julys and Augusts here. I have a saying that I've used for many years here, Ben, called "Beware the Ides of August." The strangest political things happen in August, and that might happen again yet this year. In fact, we've seen situations where Congress has had to come back into session at some point in August because of a crisis or some piece of legislation. Or I pointed out that with the 1-6 committee, you know, they say they're done until September, but it wouldn't surprise me if we have a drip, drip, drip of information or news leaks or something that's important about the Secret Service or audio tapes of Kevin McCarthy, which is what we saw in the spring, or the committee even calling a snap hearing. Keep in mind what they did in late June. You know, never before had I ever seen, in all my years covering Congress, seen them schedule a hearing of that level of import with Cassidy Hutchinson less than 24 hours during a congressional recess. At that point, I've never seen anything like that, something thrown together at that point. I mean, they had even told the TV network pools were done, you know, and all the equipment had been pulled out, which is usually a pretty good signal that they're not going to do anything. So beware the Ides of August. That said, legislatively, the first big thing that they're trying to do here is pass this CHIPS bill, this semiconductors bill. It costs about $52 billion. It would basically build a marketplace here in the United States for us to make our own chips and semiconductors so they're not made by the Chinese. Now, the administration, and I interviewed Gina Raimondo, the Commerce Secretary, last night, she makes this national security case about this, saying we can't have chips made overseas because then they'll be able to listen to us, track us, spy on us. It goes into military hardware. It can mess up the military planes and equipment and everything else. You can imagine the national security consequences there. This has bipartisan support, but there are some Republicans who are leery about this because they say $52 billion, it's an awful lot of money, and it's an awful lot of money for one particular industry. So, you know, but we think that they have 60 votes to clear a filibuster on this and pass this in the Senate in the next few days. The only thing I'll point out is that we're starting to have COVID tear through the Capitol. Just today, we've had Joe Manchin, the Democratic senator from West Virginia, and Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, fall ill, test positive with COVID here. And as I always say, it's about the math. And if you don't have those members here, they can't vote for this bill. And so if that number starts to drift below 60 in terms of those who are favoring ending the filibuster, then they've got a problem here on Capitol Hill. But they're probably going to try to move that through the Senate probably by Wednesday and then move it through the House of Representatives at the end of this week. Now, the issue there is that the House passed a very different bill some months ago. There are some trade elements in that bill, Ben. There are some tax elements which are very important to liberal Democrats. Richard Neal, the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, also Earl Blumenauer, who I talked to the other day, who's the chair of the Trade Subcommittee, and we'll see just how much they want to stick to their guns. However, there is some Republican support. And there's something else that's coming up at the end of the week that has an interesting nexus with this, which you, on its face, you look at the schedule and you're like, what does this have to do with legislation? It's the congressional baseball game Thursday night at Nats Park.
No. Let me just interject. No, this is actually where deals get done.
or don't get done.
Or don't get done.
We saw this in 2015. You had President Obama come to the dugout, walk the stands as they were trying to pass this framework for this Asian trade pact. He did not get it through the next day. Last fall, they did not hold the baseball game until the very end of September. And you had Nancy Pelosi and, again, the president, this is President Biden, you know, doing the same thing, trying to get an agreement on both the infrastructure bill and Build Back Better. Well, eventually, and it was a couple months later, they finally passed infrastructure. They still heretofore have not passed Build Back Better. But those things collide, and they always seem to collide each year. So expect a lot of the whipping going on at the ballgame. And, you know, this is not the first time this has happened, Ben. I mean, as far back as the early 20th century, Champ Clark was the Speaker of the House from Missouri, and he was trying to pass a cotton bill. There was a thing about damaged cotton from the Civil War. This was like 1914. And all the members were out playing this game or trying to get this game underway at Old American League Park, which is in the Trinidad neighborhood of Washington, D.C. It's where the Washington Senators played in the early 20th century, the very early 20th century. And so Champ Clark, the Speaker of the House, sent the Sergeant at Arms to say, we got to pass this bill because we don't have a quorum back at the Capitol. And so they lug everybody back to the Capitol. And by that point, it rained and it rained out the ball game. And then they still didn't get the cotton bill done, at least not that day. So these ball games have kind of a sordid history with the congressional schedule. But that's the main thing this week.
Chad, don't you love when, you know, legislation of enormous import to the entire nation hangs on whether someone is done with dinner or not? that's what you seem to run into all the time.
Absolutely. When it comes to Capitol Hill. I mean, you try to get 535 people in the same building at the same time, you know. Yeah.
So I want to ask you about a couple of things, but I got to ask you about your takeaway from the last couple of weeks of these January 6th committee's hearings. Over the weekend, you heard from both Representative Cheney and Representative Schiff on the Sunday shows talking about the prospect of subpoenaing Gina Thomas, that is the wife of Clarence Thomas, over emails that she had sent. And Representative Schiff in particular was open about this having to do with a Supreme Court decision in which Clarence Thomas was the lone dissent regarding their attempts to get at various, you know, material and the like. Jonathan Turley has written at his own blog and said on the network that this would be an incredible encroachment on the Supreme Court, something that would run afoul of, you know, basically every precedent that you could imagine in terms of subpoenaing the spouse of a Supreme Court justice over a dispute regarding a decision that was made and an opinion that was offered. Do you believe the committee will actually do that? And do you believe there will be ramifications if they did?
Well, you know, it wasn't that long ago when Jenny Thomas had indicated that she was more than willing to come talk to the committee. Now, something changed in that regard. We have seen them, you know, negotiate with different people. We've seen them get a lot of information, say, from Mark Meadows, the former White House chief of staff, and then yet not get everything. And then, you know, hold him in contempt of Congress. Now, he's not been prosecuted. You're really starting to set up potentially, if the committee goes to the mat here, a very interesting dynamic between Article 1 of the Constitution and Article 3 of the Constitution, even though Jenny Thomas is not technically part of Article 3. She is kind of an adjunct here as a spouse to a Supreme Court justice. And one can only begin to imagine that that would probably, if they have to issue a subpoena, that you could have a court issue here. You could have a question of holding somebody in contempt of Congress like that. Obviously, the Republicans will cry foul and say, you're trying to influence the court and so on and so forth. Democrats might turn around and say, well, you know, we're already having the court influenced here because she might be influencing her husband potentially here on cases.
Wives tend to do that in my experience, Chad.
Yes, I have that same problem, Ben. Absolutely. So not on Supreme Court cases, though. So. But we get that. So that, I mean, that if that comes to pass, Ben, that is a battle royale. I mean, it really is. And so, you know, this is where everybody's kind of edging to that. And that's where I say maybe August, that's when this all explodes, because the left is already pretty irate at Justice Thomas here because of some of the things he said about, you know, maybe reopening the Obergefell gay marriage decision. I mean, just a host
Griswold.
Of things after Dobbs. Absolutely. So, this plays on a lot of different levels here. And especially if the Supreme Court, and don't forget that, you know, Democrats will argue, well, you know, if you have an election in 2024 that is adjudicated in some way with petitions from various states and electoral college votes that goes to the Supreme Court, a la Bush v. Gore or something like that, then, you know, is it right for Justice Thomas to be weighing in on this case, especially if his wife was, you know, so involved? And if we have, you know, President Trump running once again, if he's in play, you know, again, you've got a lot of weird intersections there that we don't see every day in Washington, D.C. And trust me, we see some odd ones.
So I want to talk about the two different people who are, you know, in the catbird seat to become the leaders of each body. After November. So you have Kevin McCarthy from California, you know, set up to finally achieve his dream of being Speaker of the House. You have Mitch McConnell potentially returning to the role of Senate Majority Leader. Tell me a little bit about the differences between these two men, because they seem very different in terms of their approaches to managing the respective bodies, keeping control over the different members and determining what ends up on the floor of both the Senate and the House.
Well, Kevin McCarthy, if he becomes Speaker, his calling card has been that he's not in control of a lot of his membership. And that's one of the reasons why he was not Speaker McCarthy back in 2015 when John Boehner stepped aside. He did not have the votes. And there's some question as to whether or not he would have the votes to win and become the Speaker of the House if Republicans flip the House this fall when they go to have that Speaker vote in early January of next year. What you need is an outright majority of the entire House to become Speaker. And we've not gone to a second ballot for Speaker of the House and Speaker Gillette back in the 1920s. So, you know, this has not happened in a
long
time.
But just from your perspective, you don't believe that Steve Scalise would potentially challenge him.
We don't see that happens yet. Or, you know, another name I hear batted around is Elise Stefanik or something like that. I mean, Paul Ryan said he didn't want the job 2 weeks before he became Speaker of the House after Kevin McCarthy withdrew.
And
the reason I find this so interesting here is I always talk about, Ben, that leadership elections in Congress are not partisan politics. They are particle politics decided at the subatomic level. I mean, I remember a long time ago when we were supposed to have Speaker Cantor and we were supposed to have, there's been a Speaker Reynolds, Tom Reynolds, who was a congressman from Western New York back, about 15, 16
Speaker
years ago.
Speaker Bob Livingston. I mean, come on.
Exactly.
That lasted 15 minutes.
Exactly. And so this is far from set in stone. And that's Kevin McCarthy's biggest problem, which is why he is playing to, you know, kind of the right wing of that conference. He's brought Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene and some members of the Freedom Caucus into the fold there. I was told basically he'll probably be okay so long as Jim Jordan, the Republican from Ohio, is on his side. And don't forget that Jim Jordan and Kevin McCarthy didn't see eye to eye just a couple of years ago. In fact, it was Jim Jordan who wanted to challenge Kevin McCarthy in the House of Representatives. So that is far from clear, even if they get the majority. But that is Kevin McCarthy's biggest problem right now. And if he does become Speaker, how long does he last? because I had somebody who said to me in 2015, they said, well, I think he'll be speaker, but he'll be speaker for about 6 months. And they said, because he's not going to be able to sate the appetite of what some of the conservatives want to do. And here, you know, if he turns around and they all he's talked about so far is economy, the border, and gasoline prices and inflation. That's the main thing. And so if they're out there dealing with Hunter Biden and they're trying to impeach Joe Biden and trying to impeach Alejandro Mayorkas and everything else, you see that this is not talking about the economy. And and if they're also this is potentially dangerous for Republicans if they wind up relitigating what the 1-6 committee has done and maybe call Citizen Kinzinger, who won't be in the House of Representatives, who's a congressman right now and a member of the 1-6 committee. You see the problems for Republicans if Kevin McCarthy isn't willing to go that far or if he does go that far. So that's a danger for him. Now, you asked me about Mitch McConnell, 180 degrees opposite. He plays his cards completely close to his vest. In fact, he makes the decision a lot of times on his own what he's going to do and then gets his members to follow him. Or he has already read the tea leaves of his conference and then knows where they're going to be, or he can get them without too much muscle. We certainly saw that after he decided unilaterally when Justice Scalia died in February of 2016 that he said, you know, we're not going to consider a nominee this year. You know, that this should be decided in the next election. He didn't consult with anybody when he did that. And I will direct you to something very important that Mitch McConnell has said. You know, I've followed McConnell for a long time, and he will tell you precisely what he means. You just need to know how to listen properly. He has said, I expect to be the majority leader if we are in the majority next year. Oh, okay, that sounds right. He expects to be the majority leader if Republicans are in the majority. Now, there's people like Rick Scott, the Republican from Florida, making noise about this. You have John Cornyn, Republican from Texas. John Thune is the whip. John Barrasso from Wyoming. All sorts of people making noise in the background here. Well, you know, this is kind of the Republicans, you know, majority to lose. The House, it's a little bit better situation for them there. The Senate, it could be a jump ball, and the Dobbs decision probably did not help Republicans, certainly in swing states like New Hampshire. Maggie Hassan, it probably helped. Catherine Cortez Masto, it probably helped Raphael Warnock in Georgia. You get the idea here in a 50-50 Senate. So does McConnell hang on? Does he want to hang on? Did he already tell us that he won't hang on if they don't get the majority? And he's often put out there saying, you know, we have a history, and this is pretty much the quote from McConnell, we have a history here of screwing things like this up, meaning the Republicans probably should be winning the majority this fall, but they might not because of some of the questions about their candidates. And so maybe he's already told us what his position is.
So let me interject here. One of the things that's been, you know, brought forward many times is that, you know, McConnell and those associated with him really do have this iron fist approach to, you know, we believe in our assessment of who the candidates ought to be. And yet you look at what happened in Georgia after the presidential election, and you saw two people there, both of whom heavily backed by McConnell, with, you know, a lot of confidence from the various funds that he is associated with, that they could spend a ton of money and get these folks reelected, and they ended up losing both. You know, this time around, you could end up with a number of people coming to Washington who McConnell may not be particularly happy with in terms of determining that majority. He could end up with, say, you know, a 2 or 3 seat majority that includes people like Blake Masters, people like J.D. Vance, people potentially like Herschel Walker, though I doubt that he'll win, to basically, you know, mess up a lot of the things that he wants to do with that majority. Does that increase the likelihood that he heads for the exit before 2024 or potentially in 2024, you know, in order to, you know, cement his legacy, or basically say, I'm going to walk away from this before it gets too sideways?
Well, you know, he said initially, if we're in the majority initially here, you raise a good point parsing that statement. But again, with Mitch McConnell, he might eventually face the same problems that, you know, Kevin McCarthy would face. If you have people like Masters or Greitens or whoever here who are going to, you know, say, you know, we don't like you anyway. You know, he might have a problem in a very narrow conference, and maybe when, you know, and what you do in become the leader in the Senate, the election process is a little bit different. Nowhere in the Constitution or the Senate rules that say anything about the majority leader. There's no such thing. We didn't have majority leaders until about 109 years ago. And so what happens, the person who becomes the majority leader is the one who has won in their conference or their caucus, if it's the Democrats, and you have the most votes. And so there you go. If you have a legitimate leadership challenge to him off stage, if he has a lot of people, you know, who don't like him or think it's time to move on. I mean, I thought it was very interesting that Mitch McConnell kind of threw Rick Scott, who is the NRSC chair, under the bus some months ago. And I'll give you some stagecraft about this too, by the way, that I've never reported actually. Got a call from McConnell's office because McConnell usually takes my questions at the press conference. And they wanted me, they said, you know, here's, we want to kind of get that out there about, you know, ask him about what he thinks about Senator Scott. And I said, I don't take questions from reporters. And so somebody else, John Bresnahan from Politico, posed the question. I guess they went to John.
I guess probably, he did take.
He did. And that's not a knock on John Bresnahan. No, it's not he's a an knock. Outstanding it's not reporter. Right. And I've known John since the 1990s. But it was a good news story. It was a very good news story because Rick Scott, as soon as that question was posed at the press conference,
Rick Scott saw
that he was going to hammer him, which is what he did. And Rick Scott left.
Turned
and so there was obvious tension between those two. Yes. So, frankly, that didn't probably help the relationship.
No. One thing I do think is problematic about Scott for a lot of this is that as one of the richest members of the Senate, he has great relationships with a lot of billionaires. And so it's one of these things where, you know, the money is not necessarily something to fear losing when it comes to Scott. I know we have a limited time with you, so let me ask you this before we close up. You know, I look back at the recent, you know, history of the Congress, and I see enormous dysfunction and incapability of this institution to really work for anybody. And, you know, I've talked to Newt Gingrich about this. I've talked to a number of, you know, different, I've talked to Paul Ryan about it. I've talked to a lot of people who have been, you know, in key positions over the years. And some of them say it is permanently dysfunctional. They say that it's just not going to change. People have started to elect people who are more interested in trending on social media than they are in advancing any kind of legislation or changing anything when it comes to the work of our committees and the like. I know you are, Chad, an institutionalist, someone who believes in the importance of this branch of government under the Constitution. Do you have hope that the Congress can work again in the near future?
Well, it hinges on what is defined as working legislatively. We have seen them pass the infrastructure bill. Okay, pretty bipartisan kind of exercise there. We've seen them work on a few other things in a bipartisan fashion, which people were stunned that they got done. We didn't have the debt ceiling hit. We didn't shut down the government. I mean, I know those used to be basic kinds of things. So in that sense, it is working. Now, I will say this, that everybody always, you know, so goes back and says, oh, my goodness, it used to work so great back in Tip O'Neill and Bob Michael and so on and so forth. Sometimes not really. I mean, you know, I like to make fun of this quote, and I will always say nostalgia is not what it used to be, if you get my drift. And so I'm not so sure that it always worked that well. If you go back and look at the old movie Advice and Consent, there is a pretty distinct portrayal there in the late 50s, early 1960s of the workhorses in the Senate and the show horses in the Senate. So you have a lot of show horses. Now, that's not that different. They just happen to be on TikTok and Instagram all day long and are, you know, get a lot of mileage with their base owning people and so on and so forth. Madison Cawthorn, the congressman from North Carolina, Instagram and TikTok and social media did nothing for his credibility. So that doesn't always work out so hot. So to some degree, some of this is not new. I will say that the riot, the level of tension in the building, the level of distrust, between Democrats and Republicans is pretty darn high. You know, you probably have to go, frankly, back to the time of the Civil War. It was pretty high when Newt Gingrich took over in the mid-1990s because Democrats had had control of the House in 40 years, and there were some pretty tense times back there at that period. I had just been in Washington for a couple of years at that stage, and, you know, they were at each other's throats. I mean, it was a significant time. Mm-hmm. But you never know. You know, each Congress, each, you know, few years, 10, 15 years, you create a new paradigm. Now, I'm not shocked if we're in a new paradigm now that's probably not a very positive one for governing. But sometimes these things do come around. I don't want to sound like I'm being Pollyanna about this. But, you know, if you really look at what is actually getting done sometimes behind the scenes or the relationships, or that even though there was a tremendous amount of pressure applied that the system held or something like that after the 1-6 riot, well, maybe that says a lot. You know, if you're going to put that much pressure on the system, then guess what? It held, and that's maybe significant. So I don't know that I write all that off, but I will not hesitate to underscore the fact that, you know, this is a pretty rough period for Congress right now, and we've seen some rough ones, but this is bad. It's toxic. Mm-hmm. You have people who don't even believe that the other side in some, you know, are dealing with reality sometimes. I mean, some of the Democrats and what they think about some of the Trump allies and some of the things that they have tweeted about, you know, 1-6 and said about 1-6. Some who literally fear for their safety. Others who catcall, you know, people across the aisle or in the hall or get in fights with them. I mean, I was struck. One of the one things, Ben, I was struck by is how the Capitol Police, which everybody seemed to embrace before, was drawn into this, not so much because of their performance, you know, on 1-6 or the riot, but how that they were somehow involved. You had Congressman Troy Nehls from Texas saying that, you know, the Capitol Police were in league with Pelosi and conducting inappropriate searches of his office and things. I mean, you know, and really putting the screws to Tom Manger, the Capitol Police chief. I've never seen that before. That's Chad, a new one. And that just shows the tension.
I promise this is the last question. Chad, you don't know this about me, but I was an intern on Capitol Hill for a media organization, Human Events, back in 1998. And I was there when the Russell Weston shooting happened. Yes. In Tom DeLay's office, which resulted in the death of two officers, Jacob Chestnut and John Gibson, which I'm sure is familiar to you.
I was here that day myself.
We've seen the increase of threats of violence against members, you know, both from crazy people and from, it looks like in the case of Lee Zeldin, just a drunk person, you know, thankfully, as opposed to someone with a sophisticated gripe. At some point, are we going to reach a level here where we need to have security assigned to prominent members of Congress in a wider swath than we have before? Because most of them walk around, as you know, with just, you know, a driver or an intern or a body man or, you know, something like that. But nobody who's really designed to protect them under the threat of violence.
You might see that because to some degree, those threats have gone up geometrically in the past couple of years. They started to go up around the time of the shooting of Gabby Giffords. You know, we saw the baseball practice shooting of Steve Scalise. Hillary Vaughn from Fox Business just this afternoon has reported that there's going to be an increased security program so that members can increase their security inside their actual residences. You know, this would cost about $4.4 million, which is not a lot of money in the vast design of things for the federal government, but that's money that wasn't spent before. And, you know, I remember a conversation, Ben, I had several years ago with Paul Irving, who was the House Sergeant in Arms, who was in charge of security and was fired after the riot on 1-6. But he said something interesting to me because I would check in with him and his office and Capitol security officials from time to time about security. And how bad is this threat? You know, is this something we should pay attention to? And he said, you know, some members, every time they get a call, you know, we have to adjudicate whether or not that call or that email, how is that a legitimate threat? And the bar for that from the Capitol Police and security people is pretty high to say, yeah, this is somebody who needs a detail. If you have 435 members of the House, you could not physically add another 435 members of security to go with them to every committee hearing.
It's impossible.
Every the House floor. And that's something that Paul Irving would always say to me. He said, there is no way we can do that. Just legit, you can't get the halls that you mean, do you know how many people 435 is? To mention aides, not to mention reporters, not to mention regular Capitol Police officers, cooks in the cafeteria here, custodians, plumbers. There's no way. So, yes, there have been significant increases in security to match those threats. But in terms of having individual details for every person, and just because you have somebody with you, you know, you really need probably 3 to 5 people on a detail.
Yeah, exactly. It really doesn't mean that much if it's just one person.
It might be a deterrent to some degree, but
yeah,
beyond that,
Chad, I want to thank you so much for offering your insight on congressional matters, both current and historical. Thank you.
My pleasure.
More of the Ben Domenech podcast right after this.
So I want to share with you a little bit of insight from my perspective on what's going on in our culture right now. It's very infuriating to see the kind of domination happening within the media landscape that suggests that, you know, there is a total minority of opinion in favor of conservative values, libertarian values, any kind of individual liberty-based values, that those are all things that basically come from some weird fringe of America as opposed to being central to our existence, which they have been, obviously, for most of our history. So I just wanted to encourage you in this moment to think of the politics of our reality as being something that is happening over a long-term period as opposed to a short-term period. People, I think, too often are sucked into the unfortunate position of basically evaluating everything as if the reality, the most recent game that they played, is where things are going to be for the time being. In, of course, the real world where, you know, there's not necessarily, you know, a bias toward things that just immediately came before, you have the ability to understand our existence as not being defined by something like this. Instead, we have the ability to chart a new path forward, one that rejects a lot of the mistakes of the leftist past. So what I would encourage you about in this moment is to understand this. The left is making an argument from a perspective that denies not just every lesson that we've learned from the founders, from the Constitution, from the Declaration, from the Bill of Rights, but it denies a lot of the things that we know about ourselves as humans. One of the first words that a baby knows is mama. They know that their mother is a mother. They're not able to be told that this is a word that's going to be redefined for them by the LGBTQ agenda. Instead, they just know their mother's name is mama. That's something that we should appreciate. It's one of these aspects of human reality which bolsters traditionalism. It bolsters the family. It bolsters neighborhood and traditional roles in terms of care, protection, hunting, gathering, and the like. Look, call me someone who has too much faith in natural law, but what I will say to you is this. There is something inorganic, unnatural, and disturbing about the left's radical agenda. We should reject it loudly, but we should also understand its defect. It goes against recognizing who we are and who we want to be. I'm Ben Domenech. You're listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast, brought to you by Fox News. We'll be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.